Welcome to the first Technically Legal podcast, Technology and the Law Done Right. My name is Ben Snitkoff, and I'll be your host for this evening. With me, I have
Dominic Rabier
and David O'Brien.
Okay, we're just going to dive right into this. So, Technically Legal is a podcast and also a website, www.technicallylegal.org. Our job is to do technology and the law and do them right because, frankly, we were tired of sitting around and hearing people muddle up technology and the law and just get it wrong or make stuff up. So we've got three stories for you guys today. The first one is about SciStar and a new company called Quo that's going to be making Mac clones. So to give you a little bit about this story, SciStar was a company that started about a year ago now. And they were making Intel computers that were compatible with macOS, and they were selling the computers with macOS installed on them. Apple, not surprisingly, sued them because the macOS end-user license agreement contains a term that says you cannot use this operating system on any computer that isn't made by Apple. SciStar just last week declared bankruptcy, and right on the heels of them declaring bankruptcy, Quo, this new company, started up, released information that said they were starting up and that they were going to have a brick-and-mortar store in Los Angeles where they'd be selling Mac-compatible computers. So my first question is for David, which is, what's the main claim that Apple's bringing against SciStar and Quo?
Well, actually, there are several claims that have been brought in the actual filings against SciStar, and as of yet, I think as far as we know, Apple has not initiated any legal proceedings against Quo, but certainly in the last year against SciStar, there's been significant litigation between the two parties. The main claim I think that we're most concerned with revolves around the end-user license agreement that is present in the Leopard operating system, and that contains a clause under the restriction section which effectively prevents a licensee from either using or installing the Apple software on any non-Apple labeled computer system or enabling others to do so. So certainly SciStar's position is that they their marketing angle is making PC computers that can run OS X. And so they pre-install the software and also they're enabling others to do it. So, in part, the main claim is one of a breach of contract under the license agreement itself. Now, additionally, Apple has included several other claims, including your basic copyright infringement claims, because software itself is generally considered subject matter or copyright. And they also have contributory theories of infringement, which basically says that a company like SciStar is enabling others to infringe on those copyrights, and either that or they're providing some sort of material contribution to the actual infringement. And there's several trademark claims also underlying in the lawsuit, basically saying that, well, the Apple logo appears in the operating system, and so either by using the name OpenMac, which is the product name that SciStar has used, it is confusing and therefore infringing on Apple's well-known trademark, and also since the trade dress or the overall appearance of the Leopard operating system is sort of inherent in the software, that by enabling it to appear on another computer, there's some suggestion that Apple might be sponsoring these new products made by SciStar, so you have additional trademark claims. And that's pretty much it for the substantive claims. They have some state law claims too, which revolve around unfair competition, basically, alleged against SciStar, of course.
Okay, so let's walk through these one by one. One of the things you mentioned was the trademark claim. Now, if I'm not mistaken, there is some precedent that says if you're just trying to make some sort of software functional on a new computer, or the case I'm actually thinking of is a Sega case. And in that case, a company wanted to make a game that was compatible with Sega. They didn't get a license from Sega to make the game, but they copied this small bit of code that would allow them to have their cartridges work on the Sega. And as a result of this, when you put the cartridge in and turned it on, the Sega logo would pop up. And Sega sued these people saying that, you know, having the Sega logo pop up there when the game wasn't approved by Sega, that That was trademark infringement. Now, how did the court rule in that case?
I believe the court said that, you know, it was okay for, it was Accolade, I believe, that was the other party in the Sega case. I believe the court said that it was okay and it was not infringement for purposes of interoperability. I think that case, though, is somewhat factually different than the SciStar case and potentially the Quo case as well, simply because Sega, at the time, was actively licensing out to other third-party developers to create games. And in this instance, you have Apple, who basically has no Mac clone program going on right now, and they're not, you know, openly licensing out their software to anyone else for use on non-Apple-labeled hardware.
Okay, so which way would that weigh in the SciStar case or the Quo case?
Well, I think it certainly hurts a interoperability argument, at least to some extent. This area is a little bit confusing, I think, and especially when you get EULAs involved, because you have certain claims of contract law, which are basically brought under state law, and then you have the copyright claims, which are separate, and they're under federal law. So a lot of the fences that SciStar is going to try to use sort of overlap in both of these areas. So while you might say that something is not a infringement, you know, if you're trying to allege something like a interoperability fair use argument, certainly under federal copyright law, that might mean that it's not infringement, but you still have the contract issue under state law. And so where you have this instance where it might not be a federal violation of law, you could still have a state violation of law. So it's a little bit more complicated than saying it could just simply weigh one way or another, but you certainly have a lot of policy considerations that the court should think about while they make this decision.
Okay, so you mentioned the End User License Agreement, or EULAs. When I go out and I buy a book, and I take that book home and I read it, nothing prevents me from, you know, passing that book off to my good friend.
Right.
Right. So why is it that if I go out and I purchase a copy of Mac OS X, I can't finish Mac OS X, take it off of my hard drive, and necessarily just give it to somebody else?
Well, software is fundamentally a little bit different than we think of other types of literary works. So for a book, for instance, you have a physical, tangible copy. And if you compare that to something like software, software is delivered on a physical medium, meaning like a CD or a DVD, but the code on it, the actual programs that are inherent on that, the media, as they become unpacked when you do the install process on a computer, that those are the intangible aspects of what is actually protected under intellectual property law. So basically, there's this thing called the first sale doctrine, under the Federal Copyright Act, which basically permits a purchaser of a copy of some sort of copyrighted work. And for an example, we could take the book, and a person is then able to dispose of whatever possessory interest, meaning, you know, they have it, they could give it away to somebody else if they wish, they could sell it to somebody else, and the copyright owner, you know, we'll say the author of the book, has no control over what happens after the first time they have sold it. Separately, if we look at software, what the software companies try to do is actually license their work. And the way that the license works is basically the owner retains title to it, meaning they retain ownership, and they license out, meaning that they permit licensees to use specific parts of the work for, usually under a license agreement, conditional or restricted uses, or, you know, very specific uses.
So is there any limit to what a company could, you know, we've all clicked on these little click wrap things. You install a piece of software and it says you must agree to these license terms before you install the software. Are there any limitations to what a company can do in one of those licenses?
Well, absolutely. So, you know, some of the misconceptions are, and you see this a lot on the internet and various blogs and news postings that there's some question as to whether EULAs, you know, as they're colloquially called, should be enforceable at all, or, you know, because the courts haven't tested them or something like that. Well, that's completely not the case. These agreements have been tested since, I think, as far back as the 1980s, and generally they are held to be enforceable, but they are only held to be enforceable to the extent that they comply with normal, regular contract law. They're treated as contracts with anything else. So that means that they're subject to, you know, they must constitute a valid offer, they must have valid consideration, no unconscionability arguments, and those are the types of grounds that someone might seek to invalidate one of these agreements by. But as they stand, for the most part, they are enforceable.
Okay, so just to clear a couple of things up, you said offer, consideration, and unconscionability. To go over those as quickly as possible, because they're kind of dense subjects. An offer is an offer for a contract is saying, you know, I will give you $400 if you paint my house. That's an offer. It's a promise in exchange for a promise. I promise to pay you $400. You promise to paint my house. Consideration is you have to have something given up on both sides of a contract. In that last case, it was I'm promising to pay $400, and you're promising to paint my house. That's consideration on both sides of it. And the last one, unconscionability, is this notion that there are certain things that you just can't enter into contracts with. States vary as to how they interpret unconscionability. Some of them require both a difference in bargaining position. Like, they would find a contract unconscionable if it's between, you know, a single little guy and some giant corporation. Some places don't require that. Some places require that the terms of the contract be unconscionable, like extreme rates on interest. Some of them require one or both of those two things. So could you talk a little bit about copyright misuse and how, if at all, that ties in with EULAs? And first explain briefly what copyright misuse is.
So copyright misuse is sort of a new doctrine that has developed very recently within the last 15 or 20 years or so. It parallels the patent law doctrine of patent misuse. And the basic tenet of it is that a owner of intellectual property cannot exceed the scope of what has been granted to them by the U.S. government. So if we think about copyrights, for instance, any original work, basically, if there's a small threshold of originality that needs to be established to become an original expression, is protected under copyright law by the U.S. government. And, you know, this sort of plays in part with the U.S. Constitution that we want to promote science and progress. And so the government is basically granting a limited amount of protection to these authors. And we generally think of this in copyright law as the exclusive rights. And those appear under Section 105 and have of Title 17 in the U.S. Code, and they have limitations that are provided thereafter also. But in general, just summarizing those exclusive rights, the author has the exclusive right to reproduce or to make copies, to prepare derivative works, meaning that they can make a sequel, for instance, to a book or something like that, or adapt it into a movie. They have the exclusive right to distribute, and also the exclusive rights to display or perform publicly any of the works. So when we think about copyright misuse, what it really deals with is an author trying to expand on the scope of the exclusive rights that are provided in the Copyright Act. And it ties into the SciStar case, as a matter of fact, because SciStar counterclaimed, meaning that they countersued or sued back in the course of the lawsuit, that Apple was essentially misusing its copyrights and trying to expand on the scope of the protection that's provided to them. And there's a couple of ways that they did this. So it depending on how familiar, and you guys can feel free to jump in as I try to explain this, but depending on how familiar you are with the Apple operating system or OS X, they and the Apple hardware, Apple uses a variety of techniques, basically, in the software to prohibit people from porting the software over to other devices, one of which is they have sort of a module that calls up a kernel panic function, and basically it stops the computer from working once it detects that a non-Apple x86 processor is being used in the hardware. And that's one way that Apple kind of stops you from using its software on other computers. Another is that they have similar methods of detecting what type of hardware is being run on the operating system, and the next time you try to reboot your computer, you basically go into an infinite loop, which just means that, you know, you have an instruction set that is unable of terminating itself, and your software becomes unusable and basically have to reboot.
Those are two of
the misuse claims.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because in the most recent update to Mac OS X, people who run Hackintoshes, non-Apple computers running OS X, have actually reported that OS X became more stable with this newest release, especially people running OS X on netbooks. So.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, actually, you know, I heard that too.
Yeah, so it's certainly not a bulletproof method that they're using. And just to go back one more, you said x86. For those of you who don't know, that's Intel-compatible processors.
Oh, right, thank you.
No problems.
So those are two of the misuse claims. So it deals with the technical ways that they're trying to restrict access, basically, to the software itself. The other claims basically revolve around the EULA itself, and these are sort of the interesting ones. So that they say that basically through the EULA, Apple is trying to expand on the scope of their copyright. And one of the ways that they do this is because the license doesn't really seem to have, even though it has a termination clause in it, I think in the show notes too, we'll certainly post a link to the licensing agreement that we're talking about. But it doesn't really seem to have a finite termination period. It just can go on forever and ever. But when we think of copyright law, copyright has very delineated termination period. So and it varies on the type of work that you have, basically. But a copyright doesn't last forever. Also, the EULA, some of the other terms in the EULA wholly restrict the way that copyright law is sort of meant to work, and it sort of takes away some of your fair use rights in some circumstances, and certainly in others it doesn't do that, but to the extent that it does, it could be argued that this is a misuse of the copyright statutes.
Okay, one thing that's corollary to this and also came up in this past week, Palm Pre announced that its Palm Pre will actually sync with iTunes, and they did a demonstration on stage at D7, the All Things Digital Conference, run by Wall Street Journal and Walt Mossberg. And when it was running, one of the people on stage chimed in that, oh, it recognizes it as an iPod. Now, there was some speculation as to how Palm got this to work, and DVD John guessed, which is an educated guess, and man's a brilliant hacker, so I'm assuming that he's right, that the way Palm does it is the Palm Pre, when you hit a button, pretends to be an iPod. So my question is, can Palm do this? And if so, can Apple stop them?
Well, I'll have a few remarks, and then I'm sure Dominic might want to jump in. There are certainly technological ways that we might think about Apple restricting other people to use any of its software. But, you know, certainly through the use of a license agreement similar to the one that we see as Apple uses with OS X, you know, there are legal ways that they could try to prevent or try to create some sort of contractually binding or legally binding obligation on anyone that's using its software and try to prevent them through that method.
I mean, that would stop me, the end user, from doing it, but it's very possible that Palm never entered into any sort of license agreement with Apple, so they wouldn't be violating any contract rights, because in order to have a contract, you need two parties that have to agree to it.
Well, that's true, but you still have the contributory infringement argument, so that basically says that you have liability on somebody who is materially contributing to another person's infringement. So with the knowledge that this license agreement does exist, and not only that, you could expand it a little further and say with the knowledge that Palm knows that there are users out there who are potentially infringing, basically that's enough, that knowledge imputes enough, as long as they're contributing to it with their device, to a theory under sort of secondary liability of copyright law.
You seem to be implying that this is a copyright claim, though, and I don't know, even from what DVD John wrote on his blog, and that'll be in the show notes too, that Palm has copied any of Apple's, anything that Apple put down in a fixed writing.
I guess we simply don't know enough right now. We don't have enough of the facts to really decide one way or another. My assumption would be, and this isn't a very good assumption, is that there was probably something that Palm had to do in order to get it, through its software, I mean, to get it recognized under as an iPod. And because of that, there could have been some sort of intermediary copying, or possibly there is some portion of, you know, something that is on the iPod device itself that is being read by the computer, or maybe there isn't, but I guess, you know, we don't have enough facts right now.
A parallel might be to the Sega case, to jump in 27 minutes into the podcast. the parallel might be the Sega case, that even if Palm did copy something, then it is for the purposes of interoperability, and it might be all right here. I'm not aware of anything in the iTunes license agreement that says that you can't use it. In fact, back in the day, when iTunes first came out, there was no iPod, and iTunes would work with all sorts of media devices. Now, those were enabled with third-party extensions with Apple's blessing, so to speak, but iTunes used to work with stuff beside the iPod, and it'll be interesting to see, because Palm's press release actually says that the Prez syncing feature is only compatible with iTunes 8.1.1, so they don't actually guarantee that it'll be compatible in the future. And it's interesting that Palm didn't just talk to Apple and try to work something out. Instead, they're taking the technological route, which might sort of get them into an arms race where they try to circumvent whatever thing Apple wants them to do by mimicking that they're an iPod, and then Apple says, oh, well, we'll detect it better this way, and then Palm has to respond to that. And it might just be easier to go and talk to Apple than try to get into a technological arms race.
So. Palm has a bit of a history with Apple. The head of the Palm Pre is John Rubinstein, who was one of the lead developers on the iPod, and since John Rubinstein came over, Palm has continuously been hiring Apple employees from Apple, so there may be a little bit of bad blood there, which actually does raise another argument that if the Apple employees used information that they garnered when they worked at Apple to get this interoperability, there may be trade secret claims. But I think we're going way off the rails here, and we're going to have to bring it back because we still have two more stories to do.
Truth is, we can't speculate too much on what the actual facts are, but certainly, you know, the avenues for all of these claims might potentially be out there.
Absolutely. So the next story that we have queued up is this Craigslist story. So the long and short of it is that a few weeks ago, the South Carolina Attorney General threatened to sue Craigslist for essentially enabling prostitutes to peddle their wares on Craigslist. Craigslist then sued in federal court to keep the Attorney General from pressing charges. And what ended up happening there is that the Attorney General consented to not press charges. So my question for Dominic is, first off, what's the CDA, which you will explain in just a second, and how does that apply, if at all, to what we're talking about here?
Sure. First, sort of a comment on the beauty of law, that Craigslist sued to prevent being sued. That's pretty much law in a nutshell right there. The CDA is the Communications Decency Act, and this was basically passed by Congress in 1996 as part of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and in an attempt to stem the tide of pornography online. A lot of it sort of wanted to regulate pornography and put criminal penalties for making stuff available to people under 18, and a lot of that was struck down for violating the First Amendment. However, one important provision did survive, and that provision's vital in this case, and that's Section 230. And Section 230 basically says that anyone serving as an interactive computer service does not qualify as a publisher of or speaker of anything that their service just propagates. And the reason this went into place was Congress wanted to provide people who basically put content online and tried to regulate even a tiny bit of it with some sort of protection so that if they failed in that regulation, they wouldn't get sued for whatever they accidentally let through. I can go into more depth, but that's sort of the broad, high-level overview that 230 once created this thing that wanted to provide people with protection for their attempts to regulate content. In other words, it basically gave this sort of safe harbor that said anyone who's an interactive computer service is not a publisher or speaker and thus isn't liable as a publisher or speaker.
So does this apply to criminal laws?
Well, there's a couple exceptions, actually, to 230 that says that it doesn't provide that safe harbor with regard to criminal law, with regard to intellectual property law. So you can't say, oh, I'll upload the latest, I'll upload a DVD of a movie, and I'm an interactive computer service. Don't I get protection? No, because it doesn't. The exceptions say that intellectual property law does not apply, state law, and then privacy law.
I would like to point out, so we're talking about specifically, it's a subsection E1 of section 230, and this will be in the show notes too. We'll have a link to the statute. The title is No Effect on Criminal Laws. Nothing in this section shall be construed to impair the enforcement of, and then it lists very specific sections of federal law. So what Craigslist would have been prosecuted under isn't those specific federal laws. It would have been the very specific South Carolina laws. Essentially, what I think they would have been charged with is accessory to solicitation.
Right, but you'll note that Section 230E under number 3 says state law. Nothing in this section shall be construed to prevent any state from enforcing any state law. And since South Carolina would be trying to enforce South Carolina's law, then that would fall under that exception.
I'm going to say you cut that a little short. Nothing in this section shall be construed to prevent any state from enforcing any state law that is consistent with this section.
Yes, it's always important to read things all the way to the end of the sentence. So.
Yeah, especially in law. So it may be that...
And that's an open question. Is this consistent? Is whatever laws that South Carolina wanted to enforce, were those consistent with that section? That's a question that I don't think we can answer right now.
Oh, would you have some sort of preemption problem then?
A preemption
laws
problem?
That were, right, correct. If you had any sort of laws, state laws in particular, that were being... pushed upon some sort of defendant that might not comply then with Section 230.
Oh, I can handle preemption. So federal preemption comes out of what's called the Supremacy Clause in the U.S. Constitution, which basically says that the law of the United States is supreme over the law of the individual states. So the Supreme Court, since Rehnquist was elevated to Chief Justice, started taking more and more of these cases. And this year alone, I think the Supreme Court decided already two and may have one or two more still in the pipeline. A good example of federal preemption of state law is that if federal government says you can't pick avocados in the month of April, and the state of California says you can only pick Colorados in the month of April, then the California law would be preempted because there's no way to comply with both the California law and with the federal law. It's a very extensive and very nuanced field of federal law. But I think David's question is, would a criminal law that put criminal liability on Craigslist for essentially reposting these things being a publisher or speaker under the statute, would a criminal law that treated Craigslist as a publisher or speaker of this material violate the statute, violate the federal statute, or be inconsistent with the federal statute?
Well, it's probably worth looking at what 230C1, which is the provision that we've talking about the exceptions to, actually says, and it's pretty short. It says that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So first it applies to providers or users. Craigslist would be a provider, and if I was a user on Craigslist, then I would be, for example, user. And publisher or speaker means that you're not going to be treated as someone who has editorial control over that content. In other words, who would have, or who is a speaker, someone who actually said something. And then another information content provider is basically the fancy way of saying another source of information, such as a person or an AP feed or whatever source of information there may be. So basically 230 is saying that no one who runs an interactive computer service or uses it can be treated as the publisher or speaker of something that they didn't say. So the only time that you can be treated as a publisher or speaker is when you explicitly publish something with explicit editorial control, or when you actually say something yourself. Craigslist doesn't publish anything per se because they don't really exercise much editorial review, and they don't actually say that much themselves on their own site because users themselves are uploading ads to their own site.
Right. What's interesting about this is that this section came out of, you know, one or two very narrow cases in federal court. Those cases were essentially people who were defamed online sued instead of the person who posted that information. They sued, you know, essentially Craigslist or the person who maintained the bulletin board and said, you know,
sued the website, in short, right?
Yeah, the website. So the person was saying, you know, you republished this defamation of me, and as a result, I should be able to, you know, get damages from you in addition to the person who initially posted it. And the government was not a fan of that. The government, the Congress said, you know, we want free information online, and if, you know, you're going to have websites, you know, devoting all of their resources to scanning every post for defamatory statements, nothing's actually going to get posted because it's going to be so expensive to check all this stuff. But since this law was passed, we see that the breadth is significantly larger. And I think, at least to the best of my knowledge, I haven't gone back and, you know, done a thorough search. This is the first time where somebody's tried to use Section 230 as a defense to a criminal charge.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, 230 has played a very important role, I think, in the development of the Internet. As we think about how the Internet has sort of evolved over the last 20 years, now it's very mainstream. It's absolutely ubiquitous, and people are posting stuff everywhere. I mean, you have entire business models that rely upon people being able to post third-party content onto the sites. You know, places like YouTube, MySpace, and Facebook, and you could name thousands more. And of course, any blog site which you're allowed to post comments to and things like that. So certainly, it's interesting to see that states are sort of starting to decide. And there have been a bunch of other news stories out there indicating some distaste for, you know, potential criminal actions that take place over these third-party contributions to websites. And it's interesting to sort of see how 230 might play a role in this. I mean, I think it's safe to say that 230 is generally a very positive law. It's had a very positive effect on the way that the Internet has been able to evolve. We want to encourage these new forums for people to be able to speak, and we don't want to have the sort of chilling effect of people being worried that there's, you know, or people, meaning individual users or websites for that matter, being worried that by creating new business models or new websites or new interactive mediums for people to interact, then we don't want them to be worried about the possibility of sort of a broad criminal action, and especially not in every state, because there are 50 states, and the Internet is potentially available in all of them unless there are some sort of user restrictions.
And it's questionable whether or not those user restrictions would be allowable under the First Amendment, but that's a story for another
correct
day.
Yeah, correct. You have and then you have, you know, technological ways to circumvent those things too.
Right. So I want to talk about just the pure criminal law implications of this, and believe it or not, there have been some disturbingly analogous cases that have been decided, and I even I'm familiar with at least a couple of them. The case that I'm thinking of specifically is many years ago, back when we still had answering services, before answering machines were common, people like doctors would give a number to an answering service. So when they were on call, the hospital would call the answering service, leave a message, and then the doctor could call in to the answering service to see if anyone had left him messages. Lawyers use these two, mostly professionals. So it's not surprising that the world's oldest profession got into this too. So prostitutes would also sign up for these answering services. Johns would call into the answering service. The prostitutes would call in and see if they have any clients waiting, and they would get these messages. So the one of these answering services was charged with essentially the same thing that Craigslist was being threatened with, which is accessory to solicitation, soliciting sex for a fee. And excuse me, I had to cough there. So the court said, when we're looking at accessory liability from somebody who's providing a service, what we're going to look at is whether or not they're making any more money with, you know, the illegal service than they are with the non-illegal services. So, you know, if the answering service was charging prostitutes more money or, you know, getting a cut of the prostitute's fee, then they would be held as liable to accessories to this. But if they were just treating them like any other client, they wouldn't have any extra liability. And I'm not that familiar with Craigslist, but my impression is that they charge for some of their services, but not all of them. Apartments listed for a fee you pay for. I was under the impression that somebody, if they were listing something in the erotic services, would be charged regardless of whether or not it was an advertisement for prostitution or not. So as long as they were consistent there's a chance that they would not even be liable under accessory liability, at least, you know, in whatever jurisdiction that case was from. I can't remember off the top of my head. And unless anybody has anything else to chime in, I think we can move on to our last story.
Well, just to tie this off, so, I mean, what do you guys think that the implications are of Craigslist basically saying we're no longer going to do erotic services anymore on Craigslist, and why they might have done that, even though it seems that there's a pretty good basis that, and it's a little arguable on both sides, that there's at least some protection for Craigslist under a law like CDA 230.
My impression is that Craigslist is still going to offer essentially erotic services, but they're going to have somebody sitting and checking them to make sure they're not prostitutes first, and they're going to call it something else.
That's tough to do, though. I mean, I'm not a person that regularly browses these things, but I certainly came across a few when we were preparing for today, and a lot of them are very ambiguously written, and they say, you know, you know, it's a posting and it says providing any services you want for X amount of dollars per hour. It seems like even a moderator of any type on the Craigslist staff would have a tough time distinguishing some sort of broad statement like that from one which clearly elicits prostitution. And I thought that Craigslist also had some sort of disclaimer that said you can't, you know, it has a post-reporting mechanism, first of all, and they had this policy that you can't post anything that, you know, expressly elicit some sort of prostitution or any type of similar behavior.
I mean, I don't think a license agreement has ever gotten anyone out of criminal liability, but I don't have, again, not the kind of thing I've ever done research on.
Right.
Generally, it's probably not the best thing for freedom of speech that this is happening, but I don't have a problem with Craigslist trying to crack down on prostitution services being listed on their site. Dominic, do you have anything to add?
I mean, they haven't really gotten that much good press lately with everything happening around them, so
certainly not.
I can understand why they are at least trying to do something, or give the appearance of trying to do something, just because they want to show that they're not completely not trying to care, I guess. And it'll be interesting to see how things develop and how South Carolina and the other attorney generals will react. I mean, from the sort of political aspect, Craigslist provides a ready target for a lot of attorney generals, state attorney generals, and they can tell their constituents and say, hey, look, we're trying to do something by suing Craigslist. Don't you love us? And Craigslist is kind of in a tough spot because they're the biggest online ad service thing, and people know what it is, and they've gotten pretty bad press just because of things that have happened, like the Boston medical student who murdered someone he met on Craigslist and all that. So just
allegedly.
And so it puts them in a tough spot. It'll be interesting to see how things go. Craigslist itself says that the CDA does provide protection because they're not responsible for material contributed by their users. And except for that criminal exception, for the most part, they're all right. Appear to be all right, and it's a question to see whether what they've done is anything criminal. They don't think they are. They have, because otherwise they wouldn't be doing it. But the state attorney generals disagree. So we'll see how things develop.
It's possible to just to add one last thought to this, that they want to avoid you know, litigation in all the states where you have potentially contentious issues on whether or not 230 might apply to this type of criminal action or not, and you know, essentially eschew all the legal fees that go along with that. And so they look at it from a business perspective and they say, hey, you know what, we don't want to put the money and resources forward and, you know, try to go through a bunch of costly court cases, and why don't we just get rid of this thing? But, of course, that's pure speculation.
Right. We were just talking about how the CDA offers protection for services like Craigslist and Facebook. But what it doesn't offer protection for is the person who initially posted that content. And the Wall Street Journal ran a story this week about how more and more people are being sued for what they're saying online, be it, you know, posted on a bulletin board or in a blog post. And there are a whole lot of things you can be sued for online, for posting something online, believe me. So, Dominic, can you give us a rundown of just some of the – let's start with the big things that you can be sued for something you post online.
Well, the two big things. The first big one is copyright infringement, and this is the one that's probably gotten the most press ever since Napster back in the day. If you post something and its copyright belongs to someone else, you can get sued for copyright infringement. And the other big one is defamation. If you say, I mean, I think there was a case where Courtney Love said something on her Twitter feed about some fashion designer, and she got sued for defamation because they said, hey, you're not saying nice things about us, and we don't think that – not only are you not saying nice things about us, you're saying not nice things about us that aren't true, which is – defamation has to be false and damaging as a little micro of defamation. But the other two things that you can get sued for, the smaller things, might be disclosing private facts or false light, which is basically saying you're saying something, but you're saying it in such a way as it's easily misconstrued.
Okay, so to go back to defamation for a second, this is one thing that I think a lot of people should be worried about, especially with sites like Yelp, where you're posting reviews of things. So to be very clear, defamation requires that you publish something, which can be as simple as saying it to somebody else, but it also includes publishing it online, posting it on a blog, on a site like Yelp, or on a bulletin board. It requires that that thing be factual, which is very important. You cannot be sued for defamation if you're stating an opinion, but that has certain caveats that we'll get into in a second. And it has to be damaging to the person's reputation. You don't need to suffer any type of pecuniary loss. You don't need to, you know, not get a contract because of it, or you don't need to, you know, be fired for your job before of it. It has to damage your reputation in the community or have some other financial effect on you. To go back to that opinion thing.
It also has to be false, actually.
Oh, right. It has to be false. That's another very important
thing. So it can't be defamation if it's true.
Right. But you also can't just couch a statement of fact by saying it is my opinion. Like, right. I couldn't legally say that it's my opinion that Dominic is an arsonist. That's not something that is subject to opinion. That's something that's subject to fact. He either is an arsonist or he isn't. Which, by the way, I'm not saying that you're an arsonist, Dominic.
Don't worry, I won't sue you for that.
Thank you. So it actually has to be an opinion. Like, my opinion is that this service area does great work on my car, which they did last time I took it to a service area that I'm not going to name on this podcast. Now, copyright infringement. How can we avoid copyright infringement? Dominic?
Well, the easiest way to avoid it is only put stuff up that you wrote or you created, because it's copyrighted by you. The more less easy, but perhaps more practical way of avoiding it is if you're trying to quote something from someone, obtain their permission, or only take so much or a tiny bit. Don't repost the entire chapter of the book that you just read, but you can perhaps quote a couple lines, depending on what those lines are. And don't post. I mean, if you didn't and have under license like a lot of music, then you probably shouldn't be posting it online. And the easiest way to avoid copyright infringement is just not to post anything that's been copyrighted by someone else. And that's pretty much everything because of the way copyright law works. I think since the 70s, copyright law applies instantly to anything that's put in a fixed expression, in a tangible format. So as soon as something's written down, it's copyrighted. So the easy way to avoid copyright infringement is just don't post anything that's is copyrighted by someone else. And the slightly more complicated way is try to get permission from people, or only take so little as to just make a point. If you're reviewing a book, you might want to say just a little quote or two, not anything substantial.
Those are great points, and certainly protectable under the fair use limitations of the scope of copyright. It's also important to note, you mentioned a couple times, just to clarify, that copyright protects the actual expression, but it does not protect either functional elements or underlying facts. We commonly refer to this in copyright law as the idea-expression dichotomy. So if someone is using facts, for instance, of things that are certainly commonly known or, you know, factual, those are not necessarily protected under copyright, but it's sort of a nuanced area too. So those are appropriate in some scenarios to use on some sort of blog site or some sort of online contribution, certainly, but you need to be careful as well, and again, only use as little as possible that is necessary, and it's always good to attribute whatever it is that you're borrowing from somebody else. And importantly, you also need to know if that there's some sort of license that goes along with the expression that you might be borrowing from a little bit. Often a lot of websites will have a terms of use provision, which you can find in a hyperlink down at the bottom. A lot of the new sites have these, and some of which are licensed under something like the Creative Commons, which is very clear, and it tells you what uses you can use their expression for and which ones you cannot. And others are more restrictive, sort of proprietary licenses, which, you know, sometimes wholesale say that you cannot use any of our expression whatsoever without our permission. And so users should certainly be careful of those types of things as well.
Just a quick point. It's also worth noting that attribution does not serve as a defense. So if you take something that's copyrighted and say, oh, I got this from Bob over here, and you don't have Bob's permission, Bob can still sue you for copyright infringement. Ben?
Well, he certainly can, but you know, I think in some cases it's always good to point out where you got your sources from.
Right. One area where we see this a lot, actually, is if you go and search for food blogs. Food blogs will very often post recipes, and recipes are either entirely... my argument would be that they're entirely functional. You've got a list of ingredients, which is functional, and then you've got the directions, which are functional. But people will often say that the recipe is adapted from and then give credit, and they'd have the list of ingredients be the same, but they'd rewrite the way that you do it. So you could make an argument that, you know, part of the way that you, you know, type the directions is an expression and not just entirely function on, you know, instructions as to how to do it. And I actually recently saw a friend of mine who copied a recipe wholesale, and I had to send her an email saying, you want to say adapted by, and you want to rewrite the part where they explain how to do it, because otherwise you may be opening yourself up to copyright infringement. Now, the other two that we mentioned were, and I lost the page.
Disclosing private facts and false light.
Thank you, Dominic. So disclosing private facts is kind of an interesting thing to claim. It's saying that what was said about me is totally true, but it's just not the type of thing that should have been published. What's a good way to avoid liability for something like that?
Again, the easy step is just to ask someone's permission. If you know the person in question, you can say, hey, is it all right if I mention this fact? And then if they're like, no, I don't want anyone else to know that, well, then that's pretty clear that you shouldn't. But if they say, oh, it's fine, then you can, if it's really important, you might want to get them to sign something, have some sort of written evidence of that. Might be overkill, perhaps, but better safe than sorry. But, I mean, be careful. I mean, it's also just a common sense sort of thing of, all right, should this thing that I know about this other person be knowable to everyone else? Just a couple minutes of common, or a couple seconds of thinking about things from common sense perspective can sometimes save you a lot of trouble.
Are there any other limitations, for instance, public figures or anything like that?
There are. Do you want to talk about those, Ben?
Yeah, certainly. So the more a public figure is public, so president, governor, elected officials are usually public figures, and there are some other lesser entities who are also public figures. Some celebrities would be considered public figures, depending on what you're talking about. The more public somebody is, the less likely it is that disclosing a fact about them would open you up to liability. That being said, this isn't something you want to toy around with. Again, you know, don't be talking about things that you shouldn't be talking about online, and if possible, ask for permission before you post it. I think are the two most important things we can stress about that. And any other thoughts on this?
Oh, it was a great post, and one of the other interesting things that was noted in the post was a statistic that was, I think, brought up by the Citizens Media Law Project, which is something that's done by the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and they noted that in like the last 5 years or so, the number of cases for things like defamation, slander, and those other types of claims that might be made against bloggers has been on the rise, and I think in the last 5 years, it's gone from about 12 a year up into over 100 a year. And I think that this is probably a trend that we'll start to see, you know, as we sort of noted before, that the internet is indeed so ubiquitous and everyone uses it and everyone's posting content and everyone's sort of a journalist, at least to some extent. And that's another big ongoing debate as to whether bloggers should be entitled to some of the other shield laws, either under state law or possibly under federal law, that apply to traditional journalists that we might think of in news media and reporting. But the trend is certainly that as we see more and more of this content being posted online, we could probably expect more lawsuits to sort of deal with this subject matter.
Okay. My name is Ben Snakehoff. I'd like to thank you all for listening to the first ever Technically Legal podcast. You can visit us at www.technicallylegal.org or email us podcast@technicallylegal.org. So signing off again, I'm Ben Snakehoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.